Hey guys, it's Katie Rubin from All the Answers Podcast, the podcast you're about to listen to. I wanted to let you know I'm doing an hour of stand-up comedy on June 13th live on the internet. That's a Saturday night. It'll be at 7 p.m. A real simple, easy way to get tickets to see that is to go to rushtix.com and search for What the Hell is Happening, which is the name of the stand-up comedy show. I hope I'll see you there. Feel free to heckle me in the chat and have a good one. Listen on.
Welcome to that spiritual, actual, factual answers to questions you're asking. You find them inside you, beside you, reciting the records of catch it. We laughing, we drafting it, passion through every. It's time for that comedy, dramedy, all of the fanciest, catchiest acronyms. Listen, we traveling. Consciousness is always unraveling. The reading you're having is mapping you back to your natural habitat. Abracadabra, it's magic, let's bask in it. To top it off, the host are the classiest. Now, what were you asking for? All of the answers, what? All the answers.
Well, hi, Damien.
Hi, how are you, Kate?
Nice to meet you.
You as well. It was a pleasure seeing your work.
Oh, what? Thanks. What work did you see?
The Taming.
Oh, very cool. Yeah. I do adore that play, and I do adore the writing of it, and I did love that character.
Yeah.
And that is all I will say now.
No more needs to be said.
I don't know. Thank you for coming on. I feel like we'll just dive in. I don't need to do a Cassidy chit-chat. Do you, Cassidy?
Nah, I'm good.
Okay, great. So, you know, Damien, I think Cassidy probably had a second to fill you in on the kind of basic structure of what we've been, you know, what this podcast is.
He did.
Where I'm... Okay, great. So I'm like this energy healer and I can open your soul and tap us both into the light of God and listen for guidance and right. No big deal, normal stuff. So at some point in our conversation, if we choose to go there, we can do that later on. But it's, of course, I don't even know the words to say, but I'm very excited to have you here and to get to have a conversation with you. A, because of obviously the current political, just the world and what's occurring and my own awakening with relationship to it. But also you have a particularly fascinating, deep, rich life series of stories that I learned about peripherally in that weird way that we all hear things on the grapevine in the culture of theater. But then I asked Cassidy directly and was like, so And then Cassidy was like, well, here's three stories from the 90 stories I know. And they all blew my fucking mind. And I was like, shit, we could talk to this guy for 3 days.
Oh, wow. You might get bored before that.
I don't think so, dude. I wonder if you might be willing, and obviously anything I ask you about that you're like, nah, I don't want to talk about that. You'll just let us know and we won't. I understand you had a very serious life trauma that meant that the world decided to incarcerate you for a long time.
Yeah.
And then not only did that occur, but that when you were in prison, you somehow managed to stay out of gang attachment, which is, from what I've read and understood, next to impossible to do.
Yeah, it's pretty well.
And I just would love to hear anything about all of that. And I have some specific questions, but I thought I could just open it there if you're up for it.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, California is the gang capital of America. Coming to California, I was an adult. I was 19. But I had already been raised, if you know what I mean. My mom and my dad had already instilled certain principles in me from which I was not in the mood to depart from.
Mm.
Going into San Quentin, which is the training ground, or the recruiting ground for gangs, you know, there was a little process by which you would take an envelope, and in the content would be the constitutions of various gangs. Whatever gang slid that under your door. And the trick was, if you read the contents, you now have vital information. So you are in, and there's no getting out of that. So I was aware of that trick. So I took it upon myself to never read them. I would just kick them back beneath the door all the time.
Wow.
And then there was this, there was an episode one day on The Yard. Now, keep in mind, I'm freshly off the streets of society, and there's a fist fight on the yard. Everybody has to get face down, you know, on the concrete, and then the gunshots went off. And I remember thinking to myself, at that time anyway, I had never known a police officer to drive up and see a fist fight and get out and shoot and kill someone. And I wondered, how was it that guards had that authority? So after seeing that and coupled with the reality of a life sentence, I could not imagine getting out of it alive. I did not think that I was going to be able to do forever at all. So when I came back into the unit, I had decided that I was going to give someone reasons to put me out of my misery. I didn't have the stuff that it took to take my own life. I didn't have that, but I had everything it took to give someone else an opportunity. But I wasn't just going to lay my head on a chopping block. You had to earn it. So the next day when I saw, it was about 8 envelopes under my door, I collected all the envelopes and I read each and every one of them. And after reading them, later on, of course, they started to come to the cell door and ask, hey, did you get that envelope? Yes, I did. Did you read it? Yes, I did. We'll be on the yard in the morning, you know, at a certain area because you in, we got to give you the lowdown. And so I said, well, what am I in exactly? Because I read a plethora of them. I read them all. So what am I in? And I knew that that would provoke a certain reaction. And so then the attempts came, the attempts on my life. But I was doing well with those attempts. I was fortunate that they didn't send seasoned veterans at me. I was fortunate to be a process that required an initiate to earn his bones. So the rookies were coming at me. And I came up a different way. I came up with these. And we didn't have guns in there. So I felt very confident.
You mean, just for clarity, because people can't see this conversation visually. When you say came up, you mean before you went to prison, the way you were raised, right, was with your fists.
Right. You know, it was common in my community to take a couple of years at the boxing club.
Huh.
So you had to know how to fight.
Okay.
You had to know that.
And where are you from exactly, Damien, if you don't mind?
Jackson, Tennessee.
Okay.
Yeah, Jackson, Tennessee. And so that was a very comfortable space for me to be in. And I wound up, you know, they escalated, of course. Knives came into play. But I was fortunate enough to survive all of that and spend a long time in the hole.
Really?
Oh, absolutely. That was not the first time in the hole. The hole was a recurring thing.
When you say a long time, how long?
No, 14 months the first time, close to 2 years the second time.
This was, you were sent there to the hole for just trying to survive?
Well, you have to understand, it's against the rules to be involved in any kind of fisticuffs. You know,
fisticuffs.
That's what they refer to it as. I know that's one of those words that's back there with ruffians and all.
What the fuck?
You young knickerbockers with your fisticuffs.
Right. So to fight, you were going to get a 115 and you were going to be placed in the hole, just if nothing else, for an investigation to see, do you have enemies? Is this going to continue? How many people will be involved because it's a sensitive thing, because there are people who could be my friend.
Yeah.
Who would feel like, okay, since they did that, we're going to do this. And then it just spreads. But I had no such friends. I was a foreigner, so to speak. I had no homeboys. I was in a foreign country as far as I was concerned.
You were, I believe the name came to you, if I'm not wrong, you were called Nation because right. You were a nation unto yourself.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that was the name given to me by an elderly gentleman by the name of Cherokee, who he saw me constantly battering against that wall, you know, trying to hold on to that autonomy that I claim for myself. And I guess that it's kind of expected that you find your groove and prison and you live along the paths that have been laid by others. I didn't agree with that. So I did the things that I felt I could live with.
But how did you get them to get off your back at a certain point?
Well, I became very expensive.
What does that mean?
That means I cost them a lot of soldiers.
A lot of soldiers.
I caused them a lot of soldiers. They couldn't send just one person at me.
Yeah.
Two people. But every time something happens like that, everybody goes to the hole.
Oh.
More people. And so I got wise about the third attack. I knew who was whom. So when they would approach me, when I would deal with them, guys that I knew that were affiliated, I would approach them too. That way, like six or seven of them go to the hole.
Hmm.
Now you have to keep in mind, in a place whereby it's dog eat dog,
mm-hmm.
there are other gangs who are not friendly with that gang that are keeping count. They just lost seven soldiers.
I see.
So it creates, and it helped being raised by a general. I thought that way.
Huh.
You know, how can I give you the greatest hurt? And so different things that you learn as a kid that you think that are useless,
yeah.
such as war can never be prevented, only postponed to your disadvantage. Appeasement makes an aggressor more aggressive. These are things you hear constantly being raised by a general. So in the hole, I wasn't in the hole trying to make a peace treaty. I just sent the threats. I was in the hole determining who I was going after the first hour they let me out.
Wow.
So I became very expensive.
I see. Okay. Before we go forward, because thank you. Fuck. What the fuck? Okay, I'm going to calm down. Before we go forward, I feel like it's also important for people listening to understand we need even more context, which is to say, here you are in prison dealing with everything you just described, and you didn't get there because you went out and did bad stuff in the world. You went there unjustly. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. They took an accident and made it that happened in my family, took an accident and made it a crime because of my attitude. They didn't give me the benefit of the doubt. They said, this wasn't an accident, you did it on purpose. And me being young and just angry at the nerve of them to do that, I was not cooperative. And not understanding the legal system well enough, it cost me. It cost me a lot. And there's always this thing in you, well, it certainly was in me, that believed some part of, well, if I know that I'm innocent, they can't in the end convict me.
Right.
So much for that. So they were very much able to do that. I actually had a DA say to me the words, and I quote, I don't care if you did it or if you didn't do it. I need a conviction. And if I throw enough mud against the wall, something will stick.
What, he said that to you?
He said that to me.
Why?
Because she needed a conviction.
But why say it to you?
Well, she said it to me because I was saying things, like I said, I wasn't very cooperative.
Oh, I see. Okay.
I was argumentative. I would say things to them because I knew my rights were being trampled on.
Yeah.
I knew it. And I wasn't going to be quiet as it happened.
Right.
And all of that cost me because it helped to paint a picture that would fit their story even better.
Oh, you know? God.
And so I didn't know this as a young man.
Sure.
I knew the system was corrupt. Don't get me wrong. I'm from Tennessee.
Right.
I knew the system was corrupt, but somehow I felt with me, they will see through in the end, and this won't be my fate. But so they gave me that sentence. And if I have to attribute my survival or my will to survive and my determination to reach for the better part of me always, I attribute that to my mother, who told me at the time of my sentencing, when my mind and my heart felt like it was in a hurricane, when they said that, I heard my mother's voice was the calm. It said, Damien, come home, the son I raised.
Mm.
And that became my grounder. That became the lens through which I viewed everything that I did. And I can for certain say that is what preserved me in my mind.
Well, I have chills all over my body. Thank God for your mom.
Thank goodness.
I have another question, if I may, which is, and Cass, obviously, if whatever you want to jump in, but like, I'm just so riveted. When you were, I may jump around a little bit because this is just
it's all right. It's
so all right. Incredible. Well, first of all, let me just own something because I'm listening to you and I'm just like, my whole life is passing before my eyes in terms of like, I mean, you just described, Damien, a world that is so far from my liberal white lady upbringing and my any context of anything I have anything frame of reference for, right? Like a general dad who teaches you, and then you're boxing all the time, and then you're a black man in America, and then a terrible accident, and then they fuck you over because of it, and then the DA needs a, this is stuff that white ladies like myself go to the movies and see. And go like, what a sad story about a faraway thing that's happening in a theoretical universe, right? That's, I'm just telling you my life. And then you're here in front of me. I feel your heartbeat. You're loving. I can feel the spirit of you, if, for whatever that's worth. Your spirit is gorgeous. And you lived this. And I know it's not, I know it's so much more common than I know. But I need to own how not common it is in my experience so that I can own my ignorance about things and I can start to disentangle all of this. I'm just very moved by, I'm thinking about like the worst thing that's happened to me in my life and my framing of it in my head. And then to hear your story, it's like, I almost can just only laugh at myself. I can only just laugh at myself.
We all certainly have our struggles, and I've lived enough to know that everybody has a struggle.
And that's true, yeah. And you're generous for that point of view, and I appreciate your point of view. And as a spiritual teacher, I carry that point of view myself. It's just to get to, but like the physical reality you've had to navigate, I mean, I probably would have died in the first quarter of it, which brings me to the question I had about your time in the hole, The first time, the second time, whenever. I have this idea in my mind that might be romanticized, that is that like a time by yourself in a room anywhere can be a profound experience. Like, and people have spiritual awakenings all the time in contexts like that. And I mean, I have white lady friends who like pay to go to rooms by themselves. But I have a friend who just did a 20-day thing in a room with no light. Mm-hmm. They like locked her in a room with no light, black, fully darkness. And they would shove food under the door. And she paid for that experience because I'm laughing about it because it's crazy in comparison to your situation. But at the same time, there's legitimate spiritual practice in sitting with oneself with no other stimulation. And I'm just wondering, what was your experience in that regard?
Well, it was several different types of experiences. One can really appreciate time alone, secluded, but that's only when one is there and left alone. Being in the hole does not necessarily mean you will be left alone.
Okay.
Because you are hidden from the general population's view. You are in the prison within a prison, and it oftentimes serves as a torture chamber. And you have certain guards who take it upon themselves to make that even more difficult for you. So to the extent that one can be left alone, and there were stints whereby I had that, but then it was interrupted by a lot of chaos sometimes. But during those periods whereby I was left alone, it was very freeing. You know, the lack of cargo, the lack of having all of these things, the lack of having any expectations.
Yeah.
And really knowing that no one sees nor cares about you in this particular environment. All you have is yourself. That was motivation for me to strengthen myself in ways that I didn't even know existed. And then that's also coupled with what you're hearing next door. Like there was one particular time when there was a gentleman next cell over to me who had been in 2 years already when I got there, and he was losing his grip on reality. And I knew him before he went to the hole, and I could tell that his mind was coming unhinged. So having to do what's in your power to keep that person's mind grounded, knowing that doing that is going to create a backlash upon you from staff because they don't want you doing that or talking to the next person over, you learn real selflessness. Because it did not matter to me. I felt, what weighs heavier? This man losing his mind or me sustaining some physical wounds that heal? So it was a no-brainer. So you do what you must do in those situations. And you really find out that you still can love you, you love even more purely. And self-sacrifice is so second nature that it's not even thought about. It just is.
I get that, actually. Yeah. I'm actually curious to know, like, how were you able to help that guy? Like, what were you able to say to him? What was helpful? Like,
the conversation, the communication, when you hear the off statement, you attack it immediately and you bring them back to ask questions, grounding questions. Like, what was it like in your neighborhood?
Right.
You know, where's your brother at? What is he doing? What does he do for a living? You know, what did they send you in here with? What did you come? Just those things that ground you to a real place. And those things help bring a person back to the ground. Because it is so easy when you've been sensory deprived and just ignored, left alone deliberately to allow these things to occur. Yeah, I still don't think society realizes. I'm just going to say California, because that's what I can speak for. I haven't been in prison anywhere else. I know that our communities out here have no idea how deep and evil the rabbit hole goes in prison. It's deep. It's much deeper than guards betting on fights, gladiator fights, and killing the winner. And it is deeper than that. And that's what we know. That's what society knows. They saw that on 60 Minutes. They know that. But it goes so much deeper. And it is in fashion to not hear or believe. You can't believe a person who's done time. You can't believe an ex-con unless the ex-con is saying what another ex-con did. Then he becomes a holy man. You have to take everything he says as the truth. You know, but if he says the same thing against a guard, well, you know, he is an ex-con. You know, they'll say anything. So they have this built-in trick to relieve the pressure off themselves. And society is trained to just go with it. And you see that the way that mind is shaped, you see that at any unjust killing. A police officer kills an unarmed person. And the first thing they go into, well, you know, he was no stranger to the law. Well, you know, he did have drugs. And he said, this, what has that to do with anything? But it is training society on how to and how not to respond to another life.
It's fucking beyond. Ugh, it's just, I can't, you know, I'm thinking about like, okay, a question bubbles up in my mind. The first question that comes through is, I'm thinking, okay, hold on. In my mind, I go, what is the payoff for a guard to be extra murderous and evil? Like, why? Why not just do your job, try to kind of keep things in line, keep the peace? Like, why not actually just do it well? Then, of course, the next thing that comes up is racism is why. Like, racism is why. But then, or I should say, and then I sort of go, is there something else? I mean, is it just, I mean, what, do you understand even the question I'm asking? It's like, you could just go in there and do your fucking job.
I do. Racism is a very strong motor in the operations that they carry out. But there's also something very dangerous in the mob mentality.
Okay.
There are many people who join gangs for a sense of belonging.
Right.
It is no different for the police gang, the prison guard gang. And oftentimes you see these young, bright-eyed kids come scared to death. They have every stereotype they've ever heard about prison in there, but they're guard. And they become like tofu in the sense of they take up on the flavor of what they're cooked with or who trains them.
Right.
They take on the behavior of the person that trained them.
Sure.
And then to fit in,
right,
they'll do this thing.
Right.
And then you hear, it's like the Stanford experiment. You saw how that, it doesn't take long. They will do this. They will do that. They will do this. When in my experience, in all honesty, I can say this for absolute surety. In 23 years, I saw a lot of things in prison. I saw a lot of things committed by inmates. And I saw a lot of things committed by guards. But the worst of things that I saw committed happened from guards, not the inmates. when inmates do a thing, you can trace it back to the reason, the justice. There is, I'm not saying it should have been done, but there is a, you can follow it. The source of it wasn't raw evil.
Yeah.
You know, but there are protocols in place in prison. Hey, this you don't do. If you do this, then you got to stab this person. There's no other way around it. You make sense of that.
Right.
Hey, don't go in the visiting room and cuss this man's wife out at the vending machine, because there's going to be consequences when you get back to the yard, you know, and that happens. But guards is different. Guards sit back and plot. I don't like this guy's body. He works out too much. I don't like why everybody respects this guy, this dude. Let's go and search his cell. Let's plant something in his cell. I'm going to share something with you. There was this one guard, and I was in Soledad prison. I had a rapport with this man because he knew who I was. He knew who I was. I knew who he was. And we had a mutual respect. There was another young man who he'd been having issues with, a young Black man. And he told him he's been around being a guard longer than he's been alive. And he knows a lot of ways on how to make life hell for him. I watched this. I just happened to be exercising in my cell. And I looked out the window and I saw this man unkey the door, get a laundry bag. I saw him checking the laundry bag and he threw it in the cell. Now, the guy was at the library. I thought he was just giving the guy his laundry bag. The guy came from the library, went into his cell, and the officer and two other officers came about 10 minutes after he went in there, pulled him out and searched the cell and found a big knife in a laundry bag. And I saw the guard put that in there. But they had him completely hemmed up, about to go. And when we came out, I let him know, I saw you. I saw you put that in there before he got there. And you know that ain't right. And he made it all go away. Only because he was seen doing it.
Wow.
So that is, and that's PG-13. I mean, that's small. That was just one of those little things that happens every day. Yeah, it gets lost. So what is the motivation? To belong, the mob mentality, falling into the us and them.
Yeah.
Is also, it can't be underestimated. And I don't want to sound like I'm really, you know, sympathizing with the guards, but I mean, I have to speak this point to humanity. When we create a structure and we decide from creating that structure that these people are assumed good, these people are assumed bad. Mm-hmm. And of the people who are assumed bad, there are a lot of hoops that they have to jump through and self-realizations that they have to come to before they can be considered for parole. They have psych evaluations every year. We had psych evaluations every year. They were really young. Do you understand the causative factors that led you here? Can you? So you are forced to really do some deep house cleaning.
Right.
In yourself, because you are assumed bad.
Right.
The guards, on the other hand, are assumed good.
Right.
There are no psych evaluations.
Huh.
There are no, there's no motivation for them to look within themselves to seek to grow.
Right.
23 years, I've gone through a remarkable metamorphosis in 23 years of working on myself.
Yep.
But the guard only sees me in the freeze frame of that day that I was charged.
Right.
But the guard's not growing at all. So that is a disservice that society places on the guard.
Yeah.
You think about amongst the highest suicide rates, highest of divorce rates, you know, they are suffering.
Yeah.
Because of who they are.
That's right.
But society does that when you assume this one's good, this one's bad. Therefore, this one can shoot and kill people at will. This one cannot be questioned in court when everybody knows they set people up. This one's just assumed good. That is something that we allow.
Yeah.
And it is as backwards.
Sure is.
Do you feel like, I mean, we're saying prison guards, but it sounds very much like that rubric can be very directly applied to what you call the police gang, the police force, the system.
It's even worse on them.
Yeah.
I mean, police were, from their inception, their whole purpose being created was to track down escaped enslaved people. So I've never expected them to serve and protect me. I know that's not where that's not their DNA. I know that's not their DNA. So I don't live under any illusions. I know who they are. And I know what their inclination is. So they don't surprise me at all. They don't surprise me. And we've been okay with that as a nation. We've been okay with that. The inception of those people was to protect the property of the wealthy. It's the same thing.
And that property included human beings.
The property.
Well, that's what he's saying. Yeah. Yeah.
What they're there for. And we have also, nothing happens in a vacuum. Think about how long cable TV was geared towards cop shows. And think about how and that is as artists, that is something that we have to own too.
Mm-hmm.
We see how a good writer gets you to fall in love with the character. And now this character may be a police officer. And then you're invested in this character. And then they show you that this guy has really done this evil thing over here. And this cop that you're invested in just can't seem to get him. So he gets upset and he knocks him around a little bit and we're okay with it.
Right.
Because we're invested with that cop.
Right.
And know that this is the bad guy.
Right.
Well, that doesn't just stop when the credits roll on that show.
No.
That comes. So when we see a cop smacking somebody around, the first thing the foolish among us say is, well, what did he do? What was he doing? What was Oscar Grant doing? He was face down, handcuffed, and he was fighting 30 minutes ago.
Yeah.
You know, so we look for ways to let them off the hook.
Yeah.
And I've never understood why. Let's just say, well, I can't say myself. Let's say some grandma who's never shot a gun in her life. Somebody's breaking in her house and she unload her revolver and stop the threat. She can be put in prison for excessive, it was overkill. One bullet would have stopped him. Now, this woman is not a trained marksperson, but a police officer who is a trained marksman can unload their clip, reload it, unload it again, and they're not held to that standard.
They were scared.
Professionals. And they're scared, but the grandmama's not. She doesn't get to be scared. She doesn't get to be. We have really, who is it that said, the people who gives up their freedom for protection deserves neither. And that is what we have done. We allow ourselves to be scared too easy and then outsource our protection to these. To me, it's like the gang in the neighborhood coming by and say, hey, why don't you pay me $2,000 a month so that nobody destroys your store? Oh, well, I haven't had any trouble with this store. And then tomorrow he gets firebombed.
Mm-hmm.
And here they are. They show up again. Hey, $2,000, I can stop this. It's not much different.
Over 50% of the fucking of any city's budget is police. Over 50% of most cities' budget is police.
Absolutely.
We think that is how to run a fucking city. Sorry.
That is how you feed a prison industrial complex. That is how you make certain that you keep certain people. When things were established clearly for two things. What is the two most important powers to have in a society? One, a political power, right to vote. Two, the right to defend yourself. Arm yourself. Those are the two most basic. Protect yourself politically, protect yourself personally. Well, it has been an intention from the 1800s to make certain that as soon as you can, take both those rights out of the hands of Black people. Well, you got caught up in this. Oh, you can't own a gun. Can't own a gun ever. You did. Oh, you can't ever vote. So now you have no power politically. And you have a terrorist organization in the KKK that's running amok with guns and you can't defend yourself. Now, I don't know what fool would stick with that, but you have that expectation levied against you in a society in which you belong. And you're not supposed to see that the fix is in, that you're, to us, we know our lives don't matter. We know that. There's no question about that. We know our lives don't matter, but we're learning what matters to them. And so we must respond in kind. But it's this is 2020, and we're facing the same situations we were facing in 1820. We still have slavery. We still have lynchings. We still have no justice in courts.
Yeah.
Nothing has changed. And it's easy for other people to say, well, you had a Black president.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
When you have 50 million people disenfranchised and you put one in the presidency, that's nothing.
Yeah, we celebrate the exception as the sort of salve to the wound. Like, oh, see, that's okay because that. And that makes me feel better. Also, I feel safer now. I feel better about my liberal positioning.
Yeah, it's one of those. I mean, war has been declared against us, and it has never been. We know this country is very good with having wars that just last and last and last and last. And we are probably their oldest in this country. It's a war against us. And a lot of us don't want to accept it because we want to believe.
Right.
We just want to believe. I don't know if it's battle fatigue. I don't know if it's just straight stupidity. I don't know if it's Stockholm syndrome. It may be some of all of those things at various times. But we want to believe that this country wants to do right by us. But those of us who just pay attention.
Yeah.
We still can't find one incident whereby the leaders of this nation have said, hey, you know what? Maybe we shouldn't be doing this particular thing to them. But without anybody asking us to stop this wicked behavior, we're going to pass legislation just not to do it, to help ourselves not do it. They've never done that. Never have they done that. And they never will. Power can seize nothing without demand. That's a fact. It's the reason as much as this country dislikes China, they haven't ran in there with guns. You know, when there is an equal, that's bully mentality. It's coward mentality.
That's right.
And they're masters of it. And I see it and I call it for what it is, without fear or favor of them.
I'm reminded of this story from one of the kind of new agey spiritual systems where they talk about a planet. I'm going to get super woo-woo for a second, but it's related directly to what you're talking about. I think, and I'll tell you what, before I even say the story, I think the reason I'm saying the story is because it's so painful to listen to what you're saying, to like get the depth of the truth of how deeply systemically fucked things are. And this isn't my first moment of getting that, but it is, I mean, every time you get it, if you're me anyway, it hurts again, and it should. It's important growth stimulating pain. But my point being, it's so painful that my spirit goes like, is there any hope? Where is the hope? So I'm like, searching reality for hope. And the only story I come up with, I mean, just for the sake of conversation even, that has anything to do with hope is this story. And here's, this is significant. It's a story that happens on another planet, because on this planet, there is no fucking story that produces actual change results or hope. I mean, for, you know, if we look at the civil rights movement, we're all supposed to, good white liberals are all supposed to be like, but the civil rights movement happened. And it's like, yeah. And here we are. Here we fucking are still. Okay. So I have to look to another planet for some hope. And here's my hope story. So there's a planet called, or there's a race of light beings in the, if you believe in this kind of thing, right? Called the Arcturians. And the so the story goes like this, that the Arcturians were living on a planet, much like ours, that had warring factions of people or beings, races, whatever, fighting each other for land and property and power and all of that. And fighting each other because of the color of their scales or flesh or fur or whatever they had. And enough of them got together. So let me take a step back. This was a planet of beings where the prevailing culture supported the notion of ascending into the 5th, 8th, and 15th dimensions. In other words, these are like spiritual beings on this planet who are invested in light work in a real way. The culture was invested in it. Okay. And they're still fighting each other. So anyway, enough people come together, or whatever they're called. They're not called people, but that's what we'll call them. And they say, we are building a wall around the planet. energetically. That means that nobody from this planet can leave the planet and nobody from any other planets can come into our planet until we have up-leveled the entire population's consciousness to the frequency that means that war is no longer possible. So they build this energetic wall and they go, peace out, rest of the universe. We're busy getting our shit together. They get their shit together after like millennia go by. I don't know how much time. A lot of fucking time goes by. They all do their spiritual work and they raise vibrationally and war ceases to exist and unity is real and oneness is true. And everybody understands that every molecule in my body is the same as every molecule in your body. But if we look, we honor each other's differences, like it's perfect, right? Fine. So they lower the wall and then they become in the universe known as a race of beings that function from their heart. So like when in my woo-woo world, when we meet someone who embodies what we would call Arcturian energy, that's a very loving, peacemaking, heart-centered person. Whereas you could look at the Sirians or the Pleiadians, there's all different kinds of races of light beings that have different qualities. So, like the Sirians are very like on fire and awake and ready to take action. But Arcturians are like peace and love, nurturance and peace and love. And they got there because they shut the doors until the whole population changed. And oftentimes when people channel Arcturians, like if human beings here on Earth are channeling light beings and you happen to be someone who channels Arcturian energy, you'll hear them say, you human beings, at this moment, you are right in the moment where we were in a certain way when we decided to close the doors, get our shit together, and not like nobody's going out to play, nobody's going shopping until we clear our shit. And I, even if that story is just a metaphor and it's not literal, I can only say that for myself, I'm 43 and I've spent 25, maybe 30 years actively healing my heart. I mean, I'm talking about hours a day of energetic healing work, transpersonal psychology, Rolfing, interdimensional light work. I mean, I'm just a little bit obsessed with this stuff. Part of the reason I was so driven to heal every corner, every nook and cranny of my inner landscape is because I knew that if I took action in the world from a place that wasn't completely aligned or clean or like healthy, I would just be creating more wreckage. And that to me seems sort of obvious, like, right? Like get your shit together before you go out and try to like do shit and tell other people what to do. You can't be a leader unless your house is clean.
Right.
And so I struggle sometimes going like, wow, human beings still don't get that concept. They don't get it at all. Nobody's walking around thinking, give me a minute. Let me handle my shit. I'll be back. I gotta handle my shit. I don't want to say anything crazy. Let me get my shit together. It's going to take me about 20 years. When I'm done, I'll be back. We'll have a chit chat. We'll start a revolution. No, people just act from where they are with no consideration of their own inner landscape. And it makes me think of what you were saying about the guards, because normal, healthy, quote unquote, people aren't motivated to look at themselves because they're not in enough pain. I had a lot of fucking trauma and a lot of pain. And I was like, cool, can't live like this. I'm going to work on it because there's no other choice. I had no other choice. So yeah, the Arcturian story always gives me a little bit of hope. Although when I look around at humanity, I go, I don't see... Look, in a minute, if we open your records and decide to talk to the divine and do that now, you'll hear me channel voices that say very hopeful, spiritual, visionary shit. Because that's how the energy of the divine functions. The energy of the divine is unity and oneness and love and connection. That is God. That is love. Cool. That's my spirit. When I'm in that space, I can hear that and channel it and share it with the people. But when I wake up as a human lady every morning and I go to the dog park with my dog, I do not feel great about the percentage of humans that are bothering to look at themselves closely enough to create the change that would need to happen for things to change. Even though, I mean, anyway, it's difficult to look around and go, where is, and I'm always hunting. I'm always listening to podcasts and I'm always watching TV and I'm always listening. I'm going like, where are the okay, the Harvard people, the Stanford, who is it? That's Bill Gates. Who are the Black leader, Rachel Cargill? Who are the people? Where are, I need to feel like there are enough people giving a hard shit about themselves and their journey to look inward that I can have some faith that we're going anywhere productive. But it's difficult sometimes to look around. I'm walking around, I'm at Safeway and I'm seeing a lot of bullshit.
Yeah.
And spiritual people will try to spiritualize that kind of thing away. They'll be like, well, that's the lens you're looking through. And like change your point of view, change your reality. And I'm like, I've done enough work at this point to understand that you cannot mentally reframe reality in a way that dissociates away from what your feelings know. Your feelings know what's happening. You know what's happening. There's no way to... But so if you put a positive spin on it with your little fucking brain, that doesn't break racism apart. Right. That's just you putting on weird glasses and living in your own little reality. Anyway.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what it will take to reach that level. I mean, we would be doing wonders just to end systemic racism. I mean, and I think that one of the most effective ways to do that is to teach accurate history. I think in those little divider chambers called classrooms in public schools,
yeah,
that we have, I think that I truly believe with all my heart, and I could be wrong, I just haven't seen the empirical data to prove that, but I believe that public school systems are there for the sole purpose of preventing people from achieving the skill of thinking critically. I believe it serves that purpose. If it doesn't, it's certainly achieving that outcome consistently.
That's right.
The framework of the public school system was designed very specifically to train people into the worker mentality. That's again, like you got to learn the history and then you find out that the history of the school that teaches the history is one of,
Yes, there's a lot of the lies that are taught in history serve to give some people the notion that they are better than other people, and it makes another group feel that they are not as important or dynamic as another person, when the simple truth would fix all of that for everybody. And there has been no intention whatsoever of putting that truth out there. I personally feel like, I mean, when I was going to, I was fortunate. My parents were very, very erudite. They made certain that we knew certain things that we would never find in that book. So I didn't drink the Kool-Aid, but a lot of my classmates did. So some of my classmates I could see, they felt very confident going up against anybody in math, anybody in science, and all of the English, all of that. But it was when it came to history that their self-esteem took a hit, and that is by design. And that caused people to disengage
right.
in class, and that could mean disengage from math, engage from science. And it happens constantly, all the time. And so if we're not going to teach the truth, don't teach my child history at all. I'll take care of that. Math, fine. Science, I mean, music, you know, English, all that. We can do all of that. Civics, but history, I'll teach my child that. Because that is going to be, self-esteem is very important. And I think that's one of the reasons I never felt inferior to anyone in the belly of the beast in Tennessee. I always knew my value, always knew my worth.
Because your parents taught you correct history. I see. Wow. That's incredible. I'm inclined to, such a fucking good point. Another thing that's happening for me and during all this time is I'm going, okay, do I go back to grad school to become a teacher? Do I go back to grad school to become a lawyer? Do I go, which system am I going to, I'm like, clock, 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 you know, anyway, a lot of white people are going through this thing of like, okay, what do we do? And we're doing things that we can do. I'm just listening to you going, oh, great. Okay, well, that's fucked. Here we go.
Do something.
I'll tell you some things that I think, and I, for the sake of relations, we have to use this black and white thing, even though neither one of us are black nor white, but we use that for the sake of relating.
Right.
if we have allies, if we do have allies, when we decide that we're going to boycott something, boycott it with us.
Okay.
We say that we're going to spend our money in Black-owned businesses.
Yep.
Shop there also.
Right.
So that they, because of the socioeconomic situation, some of our people are in a position truly to whereby it hurts them even more in the short term to shop at Black-owned businesses because they may have to travel farther. They may have to pay more.
Yeah.
But perhaps if our allies were doing it too, that could make up the slack of those who fall off.
Right.
You know, and they yes. can feel that. I grew up playing football. I eat, sleep, breathe it. It is, I still tremble when I walk through the park and they throw in the ball. I feel that hand like, But ever since Colin Kaepernick took a knee, I have not turned my television on the NFL. And that is a sacrifice for me.
Yep.
But it's too expensive not to honor that.
Of course.
So join those things with yeah. us if we have allies.
Yeah.
You know, and yep. that's, I would never encourage anyone to put their bodies in harm's way. I wouldn't even demand that of the affected class.
Mm.
They'll always decide what's worth it for them.
Yeah.
But all those other things can definitely help. Boycott what we boycott, shop at Black-owned businesses, find who's... There have been so many different levels of attack waged against us because, like I said, I live under no illusions. We are at war. We have been at war in this nation. We are an occupied nation of people.
Hmm.
There are so many points of attack that we face. We will eventually prevail. But it doesn't have to take as long as it would if our allies would be allies.
Right.
You know, and understand that a little discomfort on your part.
Yeah. Yep.
Is just they're balancing death on another part.
Yeah, that's right.
You know?
Yeah, I do.
You look at the housing situation. I mean, look at all the homes that Black population owned in the Bay Area before the crack cocaine epidemic that we didn't start. And then how the property value decreased and the heirs, the normal heirs of that property in Hunters Point, Western Addition, all the, you know, these areas, West Oakland, East Oakland, all of the property value dropped. And you have sons who have been murdered from the drug war. You have sons who are zombies from the drug war. You have sons who have suffered under the prison industrial complex because of the influx of drugs. The property value drops. The grandparents, the parents can't leave it to anybody. They came in and seized it for pennies. 25 years of this program happening, depopulating our communities of the men, making zombies, stealing the property. Then after they have a stronghold on the property, open up the prisons, let them out now, but you can't come back the way you were because you can't afford it. You get it is systematic in how that occurred. And that systematic operation was encouraged and allowed because of systemic racism. And so then we'll say that, oh, well, they were on the drugs. They were on. The Kerner Commission report should be read and understood by every literate American.
Say that again, please.
The Kerner Commission report.
Okay.
When the president set a panel out to find out what happened in 67 with these riots. What happened? Read the report and what they came back with.
Do you think that the report, just for some framework, if and when I read it, are you saying that the report is revelatory and it tells us things, or is it?
Yes.
Or is it political bullshit? I just didn't know which.
When you see what the answers were, and then you look at the course that the nation took after that, you can see that we were clearly attacked.
History.
Was systematically attacked, and we're still under it right now.
Ooh.
But most of even my people haven't even heard of it.
I haven't heard of that particular document.
Lots of people. See, it is not just us, even though we are the primary targets. It is not just us who suffer from inaccurate histories. It also makes unwitting white people allies to white supremacy, you know?
Yeah, that's correct.
So We have to get truth out. We have to show what we are about we know that it's far from balanced. We know it's far from balanced. And we should not be okay with it.
No, we really fucking shouldn't. And we in this room are not okay with it. There's a woman, maybe you guys know of her. Her name is Heather McGee. I just heard her interviewed. She has a podcast called Racism. Sorry. She has a TED talk called Racism Has a Cost for Everyone. And I heard her talking on Armchair Expert, which is my little favorite podcast I like to listen to. A couple days ago, and she was talking about the economics of racism and the specificities of how it works. And she talked about, I'm going to poorly attempt to replicate just her one point she made very eloquently about the 2008 crash. She explained it how it was like shitty, unbacked, poor mortgages that were fucked, as we all know that part of it, were sold. They like the white mortgage brokers who figured out, wait a minute, we've been deregulated. We could do whatever we want. They like were knocking on the doors of people who up to that moment in history had been considered, quote unquote, like bad credit risks. Like you don't even bother trying to sell mortgages to black and brown people because they can't handle it or they're whatever that racist idea is. Then it got deregulated. So they went and they were like knocking on doors of black and brown people being like, hey, did you know you could just like pay less and also your mortgage would stay the same and blah, blah, blah. We won't mention that in 10 or 15 years, there'll be this huge increase in your interest. And then you'll have this huge balloon payment. We're not going to mention that, but it's buried in the fine print. Her point being, it started that way, which is fully like, oh, let's manipulate this population of people and exploit this population of people who don't know any better and they're going to feel special because they've never been fucking even looked at, let alone offered help with their mortgages because nobody believed in them. So then cut to, so they sell them, it happens, then it starts to expand into they're selling it to everybody, then everybody's buying it, and then the crash happens, and she shared a percentage that I can't remember now because my brain is a sieve, about the majority of people, the largest amount of money lost in the crash of 2008 was by white people. Like, white people suffered $19 billion or something of fucked mortgages they fucked themselves. Like, it's not like we don't suffer like our own racist actions. It started as a racist action, led to everybody's fucked. And her whole TED talk is on that concept. She's really doing an excellent job educating people about specific ways that racism not only is, but also is fucking everyone on all these levels across all societal portals.
Yes, and I think that it's really making us something that I know is not thought about a lot. It makes us vulnerable as a standing army.
Vulnerable to other countries' attack type of thing?
Yeah, because you have to think about it. When you have, 100 million people in your country who feel like they're getting fucked over, that 100 million people could be your Trojan horse. I mean, this is just practically, I think like a general at times. I got it honest. But when you start looking at it, it's like, what kind of foolishness are you up to? Did you really think 100 million people in this country is of no consequence?
Right.
Especially when really just look how, and I can't separate myself from, I am an American. I am a Maru Khan. So I cannot separate myself. I exist here. I'm a citizen of here. I see how the world is looking at us. It's like a bunch of morons, just who we elected as president. Like, are you serious? How many of you were really serious about electing that guy? Lots of us. So we're a joke in the world. We have no unity. Patriarchy is still in question. Our patriotism, rather. It's what we know the patriarchy is very much in command, but it's a breeding ground for something terrible to happen within. And that is usually what happens before an attack without.
Interesting.
Because it's encouraging.
Right.
It's very encouraging when you catch the great Kung Fu master drunk.
Yeah.
There's no better time to attack.
That's right.
Seems clear to me.
Well, You've given us a lot, Damien, and you know, I'm curious to hear a little bit about your time. You know, having come, this is kind of a gear shift here, but coming out of prison and then winding up working as an actor, like A, rock on, and B, I wonder if you're up for talking about that a little bit.
Yeah, sure. You know, I never considered myself an actor at all. As a matter of fact, when we did that play Inside, I only did one play Inside with Marin Shakespeare Company, and I was terrified. And I asked Leslie for the smallest role in the play, and she gave me Macduff. and I didn't know how these things worked, right? Because I had asked for the smallest role, I kind of thought, okay, I'm going to get that because I'm the only one that asked that. So then when the exercises were coming around, which I found out later were really assessment, you know, who has a skill set for something, I was giving it my all because I was happy for the little role. But after seeing my range, mm-hmm. like, nah, you need something bigger. And so I got Macduff, and I was not happy about that. But
how did you get connected with them in the first place, with that particular company?
Oh, they actually there was a flyer that came into the unit, and it had Marin Shakespeare Company, acting classes.
So it was Shakespeare Behind Bars program.
And I wasn't going to sign it, but nobody had signed the list. And I wound up signing, because I know how people operate inside. If they don't see reputable names, they're not going to sign it. So I knew I was pretty reputable inside. So I signed my name on it. And then it was filled out. And it's a funny thing, I had no intention of going. And when we received the passes to go, my friend Jamal came up and was like, hey, let's go. I heard him call you for your pass. I said, I'm not going. So he harassed me for a while. And I said, look, man, I will walk you to the door when I'm not going in. Uh-huh. He said, okay. So I walked with him. And as fate would have it, the yard was not open yet. And there's a whole different dynamic there. The yard being for prisoners to be out on the yard exercising, moving around freely, it had not been open for that. You could only go to your passes, you know. Well, when we got to the door, they had already let in everybody. So the door was now locked and the yard wasn't open. So we were, in all effects, out of bounds now. Subject to disciplinary action. And so we look up and it's this, oh, I can't remember this clown's name for the life of me, but he was the worst guard to catch me, for sure, out of bounds. And he saw us over there, and I'm telling you, he had joy in his eyes.
Oh, God.
Finally catching me out of bounds. And he was coming over full speed, you know, I know he was going to get the write-up and all that. And he got halfway to us. Leslie unlocked the door.
No shit.
So then my friend was like, so you going to stay out here? I went inside, and that's how I got in that class.
Wow. And then how much time went by before you got out of prison and then met up with them again outside of prison?
I got out about 5 months later after we had done the play. I got out about 5 months after the play. And I went to see a show because we were told that we had did a performance with them. We had a lifelong pass for us and a guest to come to a show.
Huh.
So I went to a show and I saw Richard III. And it was just amazing. I mean, it was amazing. I mean, I had done a prison performance with pool sticks and swords and, you know, like right out of the fifth grade talent show or something. But watching a professional production.
Yeah.
With all the fixing.
Yeah.
And looking at the line load that everyone seemed to be carrying effortlessly was very intimidating. Very intimidating.
I bet.
And of course, I said, I can't play on that level. That's a whole different level from what I feel like I can do.
Huh.
And it was that night that, you know how the couriers are.
Uh-huh.
Don't waste any opportunities for...
carousing.
Yeah. So Bob called me up to the front and asked, was it okay to introduce me as a person who is part of their program inside? It's like, okay. Sure. Which that's never been my thing. I don't like to, but I'm on stage and it's probably about easy 400 people out there.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm standing on this stage and looking at all those people and just very nervous, let alone performing like that. And he said, what do you guys think? He said, Othello 2016. And so the crowd was like, yeah. And I was like, no. But they had a lot of faith in my ability to do it, more than I had. And I have to give Leslie credit for this, for sure. She believed in my talent level of acting when I had absolutely no confidence in it. I had none. And she did. I have to say, and that's one of the few times in my life that I can say that somebody believed in me more than I believed in myself. No. And then she put me around people like Cassidy, Elena, you know, Jeff Weezer, my goodness, Regina Moronis. I had so much support, you know, and watching Steve Price and how he prepared backstage all the time was just intimidating. This guy's doing his lines four different ways before he go on stage. And it was just a university of learning and having to, I had no car at the time. So I was going to rehearsals with,
it was me.
Elena would take me to rehearsals.
Cassidy.
I did most of the time. Yeah, I feel like we did most of the commuting together.
Yeah, we did. We did a whole bunch. Yeah, me and you. But that was sitting in the car with Elena, with Cassidy. It was like I was getting taught. I was getting trained. People who had spent money on getting this elite acting information was generously giving it to me for free. And so, of course, I was paying attention, you know, and because I could clearly see that they were on a whole different level acting. I'm grateful for that because I would not have done as well as people feel that I did had I not had the benefit of their expertise and the generous sharing of it. And they I never felt like I was burdening them. You know, I never felt, and I had to learn some things, you know, I was learning every step of the way and they were giving it to me, you know, and I guess I was just smart enough to know to shut the fuck up and listen and learn.
All right, I got to jump in here because I have to say something about why all that worked so brilliantly. Because in my assessment, this is just from hearing your stories and all the things that you shared with me and how you navigated things. Your superpower, Damian, has always been, I think, this is my opinion, my observation, that you stand in the corner of a space, scan the entire domain, and determine the best course of action and what is it going to take to achieve the best ends for everybody, not just for you, but for the whatever. It's like a, you know, Sherlock Holmes movie when they go boop, 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 boop. I saw you do that every day, whether it was in conversation, whether it was taking direction, if it was good direction or bad, didn't matter. You were like, boop, 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 assess, determine, source of information, Elena, achieve information, boom. Like that was so that to me was like, we were all doing that together, like to watching. There was no, you know, I think in my estimation, there was no teacher, student, there was none of that. It was just, it was this people sourcing each other for what was for the best possible outcome in any given situation, at least in that little tiny world that we are living in. So that was just, I watched that happen every day. And it was an absolute like, oh, reminder to myself to do that as well. Like
directly a product of being terrified, Cass.
And I mean, I don't mean to make light of it, but that sounds like a product of being terrified in all the ways. Like when you were behind bars, all those things, when you were being oppressed in all the ways, your ability to you know, your general father, like boop, 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 line up, troop, whatever, execute, possible plan, best outcome. And in our case, it was being able to be done through love and us, you know, and people working joyously together towards an end. And I'm just ever so grateful for
that.
Well,
I can't thank you guys enough, man. I'll always, of course, that was my debut, you know, professionally. So I'll always remember that, but I'll always remember that for a lot more reasons, you know, and I have yet, I've had some great experiences after that, but none like that, you know, and I thank you guys for that.
Me neither. Me neither. When are we going to be in a damn show again, man? It's been too long.
All right. Do you have interest, Damien, in doing this records thing? There's a way that I feel a little weird kind of transitioning into it. It feels like sort of weird. I don't know. Like, I don't know. Do you want to hear the divine light give you some answers to some questions?
Of course.
Through the filter of this white lady here?
Who would refuse the potential of such answers?
Well,
there it is again.
Okay. I have to pee. So excuse me. We're going to take a quick pause and I'll be right back.
I was just prepping Damien for asking a question.
Okay. So, do you have anything in mind, Damien, while I open this document?
I do.
Okay. Okay, good. All right. Let me just read on. Are we going to use this prayer, one of these prayers? Okay. We're going to use one of these today. So there are different prayers that one can use to open the Akashic Records. And there we go. I like to energetically read like what's in the highest for this particular individual. And so I just found the one we're going to use.
Can you give the 1 minute Akashic Records breakdown? I said some words, but I don't know how true they were.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. So every human you meet, you know, as is the case on any topic, right, is going to have different things to say about what the Akashic Records are. I can only share what I've been taught and what I experience them to be. So that's my little caveat for anybody listening who would frame this differently. But from my point of view and my experience with them, they are the word records is a little bit of a misnomer from my point of view, although certain people really disagree with that idea. And they say, no, literally, it's like a hall of records. To me, the Akashic Records are a realm of consciousness, that is super high vibrational, aka it's very close to what you might call the source of God or the center of the light that is the great creatrix of all time, dimension, space, and reality. So if you imagine that, like, you know, let's say metaphorically, the universe is a light bulb from which light is shining. And all the things that exist in the universe are pieces of that light that shine outward from the central bulb. My experience is that the Akashic Records sit right in the middle of the most heated, bright light source of all the light that is. So when I am sitting energetically, spiritually in your Akashic Records, Damien, what that means is I'm sitting in your soul and its alignment with source. So I'm sitting in the highest vibrational frequency of you as it is merged with the divine, such that I can see, feel, hear, know, receive lots of information about your past, your present, and your future, because time in the realm of God is not a thing. Well, it is a thing, but it's a very different kind of thing. And a lot of people experience the Akashic Records as, and I have to have my eyes closed while I'm telling you this because I'm sort of listening / channeling some of this. A lot of people experience the Akashic Records as like a library where they're like in a hall of books and the books open and it's like Damien, and you flip, 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 and you literally see like the history of Damien in the book of Damien. Some people experience the Akashic Records like one single book that you're flipping through and then there'd be like a chapter on Damien. So people visualize it or imagine it or experience it through their various portals of experience, eyes, ears, body, feeling, sensing, etc., differently. I happen to be quite a kinesthetic person. So for me, I feel everything. I hear, see, feel, and know. That's how I receive psychic information. I hear, see, feel, and know. Some people only see psychic information. Some people only hear psychic information. Some people do 3 out of 4. Like, it can happen in any number of ways, right? So when we say this prayer now, when I say this prayer out loud, what it's going to do is connect me to you, you to me, and both of us to the divine in a very high frequency realm of consciousness where the entire history and future of you is recorded, if you will, or kept track of. So that was a lot of words. How's that land for you?
Oh, that's good.
Okay.
I'm clear. I'm clear on it.
Okay, great. Sometimes, you know, it's a wacky thing and it's a super sort of like out there notion for some people who are not into spirituality. So I always like to check in with people just to see, like, is this fully outside the realm of your belief system, or is this somewhere near something you could buy into?
Oh, yeah, it's certainly not outside.
Okay, great. Thank you for helping me know that. All right. So we'll go through just a really brief meditation. We'll just close our eyes. I'll talk us all through little 4-minute meditation. I'll say the Akashic Records prayer, and then I'll let you know that they're open. And then I'll say, like, okay, you can ask whatever you want to ask now. All right. So let's just close our eyes just for a moment. And we're going to feel our feet flat on the ground. We're going to take a couple deep breaths into the low belly, allowing the shoulders to relax and the chest to relax, breathing deeply into the low belly, allowing the belly to fill and then release and fill and then release, allowing the shoulders to stay calm and the chest to stay calm. Simultaneously, we're going to come into contact with the bottoms of each foot. We're going to visualize, imagine, allow that there is a little foot chakra or energy field at the bottom center of each foot that begins to open right now, like a little tiny hurricane or a little tiny portal or a little tiny circle of energy that opens at the bottom center of each foot, allowing the bottom of each foot to become an open space spiritually, energetically, in our mind's eye, that connects the electromagnetic field of your body down to the electromagnetic field of the earth. Just seeing, imagining, allowing that to be the case. And as you feel those portals opening at the bottoms of each foot, visualize, imagine, or allow there to be a complex structure of roots that grow out of the bottoms of each foot. 500 roots grow out of your left foot, and 500 roots grow out of your right foot down into the earth for many, many miles. Dozens of miles and then hundreds of miles down into the earth, complex roots. And these are energetic spiritual roots. This is your energy field extending into and connecting with the earth. Great. Ooh. Okay, really nice. And then from there, we're going to imagine, visualize, allow there to be a grounding cord, a tube, a tunnel, a channel, however you like to conceive of it, that shoots from the base of your spine down to the center of the earth. Grounding cord that shoots from the base of your spine all the way down to the center of the earth. It's about a foot and a half wide. And as that grounding cord descends to the center of the earth, the soul of the earth, Sophia Gaia, the spirit of the earth, begins to travel up. The energy that the earth desires to contribute to humanity travels up your grounding cord, travels up the grounding cord into your root chakra, flooding your root chakra, nourishing your root chakra, and then splitting off into each hip socket. So you can see this like a mist or an energy or a light. It splits off into each hip, floods down into each glute, through each quad and hamstring, Allah, down into the knees, down into the shins and calves, down into the ankles and feet. Yeah. Down through the root structure that we just extended into the planet. Divine light from the earth flowing now into those roots that we extended from our feet, nourishing them with the spiritual energy of the earth. And now we have what we like to call a tripod grounding structure, connected through the roots, connected through the divine light of the earth, in three points of contact, the root chakra and the bottoms of each foot. Okay. Now, last step here, you're going to visualize, let's see, is this required or shall we go straight to the prayer? Okay, we're going to go straight to the prayer. So Damien, what's your full legal name, the name that shows up on your driver's license?
Damien Dupre Brown.
Thank you. All right. So just keeping your kind of connection to those grounding images. Yeah. And continuing to breathe into the low belly as you feel able and willing. We say, Allah, divine lords of unconditional love, Ya Shafi Alali Makudus, please help us to center fully in this moment as we create this sacred space. Please wrap us in your love and protection. Allow us to travel to the highest realms of the Akasha available to us today. For those Akashic Records nerds listening, this is a Lisa Barnett prayer. Please help us as we lay our multidimensional hearts open to divine love. Amen. And release all resistance. Lords of the Akashic Record, please guide us to the deepest truth we can access now. Support us in healing and releasing that which no longer serves on our true path. We give great thanks for your divine love and support on this journey. Divine Mother, Father, Goddess, God, please hold Damien Dupre Brown in divine light and love as we make this journey. Keep us guided, guarded, and protected as we travel in these Akashic realms. Akashic Lords, Masters, and Teachers, please show me what it feels like to be a clear channel of the Akashic Record for Damien Dupre Brown. I ask the assistance of the record keepers of the Akashic Field to take us deeply into the records of Damien Dupre Brown and teach us the truth of the soul. I'm going to go quiet for about 20 seconds. Just continue to breathe into your low belly. Okay, so the records are open, and I'm just going to say right now to the Lords, Masters, and Teachers of the Akashic Records of Damien Dupre Brown, heretofore referred to as Damien. I'm just asking that you align me deeply with his records, that I can receive information with great clarity for him, and any healing that desires to come through comes through with great clarity. Namin. All right, so record keepers, do you have any information off the bat? No. Okay, so they're just here for your questions when you're ready, Damien.
Okay, I would like to know, should I be going back to the Southeast, namely Tennessee, to work with organization there?
Which organization?
Liberation Fronts.
All right, so record keepers, is it in Damien's highest good to go? Okay, so as you were formulating the question out loud or saying it, like, it's a huge yes before you even finish the question. There's a soul alignment for you with this work and a soul calling. There's also a feeling of like, there's a lot that comes along with it for you. There's a lot. It's like returning to an energy, returning to a place, the leaving a place. There's a lot that goes with it. Is not an indication that this should not happen. It's just a normal amount of a lot, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. Is there more information for him here? Yes. They're sort of like, what other questions do you have about that? Lest I just keep pontificating.
Should this include family or should that be avoided?
What do you mean?
Meaning, should I utilize family in this work or should I take on this by myself?
Utilize them how?
Well, they still exist in Tennessee. So should they be a part of their work or should the work just go forward without them having to be a part of it?
I see. Okay. Record keepers, is it in Damien's highest good to involve his family in this work? Is it in his highest good to not involve his family in this work? Okay. Well, it definitely reads that they want to be involved. I think I need more specific information. When you say family, are we talking about a partner? Are we talking about kids?
Siblings.
Siblings, like brothers, sister. What do we have?
Brothers and sisters.
How many?
There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 brothers and 3 sisters.
5 brothers, 3 sisters.
I'm sorry, 6 brothers, 3 sisters.
Oh my God. I don't think I have that many friends. Let alone family members. 6 brothers, 3 sisters. Okay, so record keepers. Will all of them be involved? No. Okay, a bunch of the brothers will probably be in. At least four of the 6 brothers, definitely involved. Sisters? Yes. All 3 of the sisters? Yes. Wow, that's a big yes. I feel like the sisters are like down for it. The brothers are... They're just dudes. They're sort of like, yeah, sure. Yeah, we'll do that. Or they're like, yeah, we'll do it. But the sisters have like, I don't know how to explain it. Bright, light, strength, energy about it. They're like, fuck yes. And the brothers are like, yes, that is the correct thing to do. We will do that. Okay. What was the reason, Damien, that you had a question about involving your family or not? Like, where does that question come from? Concern for their welfare or what?
Concern for their welfare. Liberation is dangerous work.
Yes, indeed. Well, and so this is where we say, you know, everyone has choice, right? People have choice. The sisters feel to me, these three women, okay, they feel like they've made their choice already spiritually. There's no question about the choice. The brothers, there's like a little more, what is that? Will you show me what that energy is? There's just the pain. There's the pain of the grief, of the sorrow of already having lost so much as like Black men, and just as men, and they're just grieving, and they're scared a little bit. They should be. And scared is sort of not quite the right word. It's more just like there's so much around it. And I think culturally they don't get to be as, you know, women have carte blanche to be like, I am hurt and sad and having feelings, and therefore I'm taking this fucking action already. Whereas men sometimes have to, socially, generally speaking, not always, but of course, subtly, we've been programmed to believe they have to bottle that shit up. So there's like a hazy kind of like, oh God, around it for them, but it doesn't mean they're not going to do it. And so, you know, you get to offer to, how do we say, you get to offer to offer it. You pose it as a question, as an offering, as you would, you know this already, and they will make their choices, and they have choice, and they know that. Maybe there's more, you might say, like social pressure on the side of the men in the family, more like, I probably should because. Whereas the women are like, no, no, that's what we're doing. How does that land for you? And what else would you like to know?
Well, that lands well. Makes sense to me. And should I take up roots there? Should I just buy a home there and be?
Well, I get a big fat yes on it. Now I'm wondering something while I'm sitting here, which is like, what would be the reason not to?
Well, that is my roots, but I hate the mentality of the South. And it's exhausting.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of work that needs to take place there.
Right. So let me ask, I'm going to just go ahead and ask some questions out loud. So first of all, record keepers for Damien, is the big yes mostly about him getting out of California? No. Is the big yes about him going specifically to the place he's asking about? Yes. Okay. Is there a way, can he have a more, just a less painful experience there? Yes, that's a big bright yes, actually. I just think it's going to be different. Not different like, oh, all the problems are solved. But there's some kind of something that's different about it now. Are you going with, let's see, why is it different? Or how will it be different? Power, strength, you're different. Time has passed. Alignment, family, support, love, who you are. The alignment you have, Damien, the alignment you have with integrity, strength of a new kind, softness. There's a softness they're pointing me to about you that has integrated itself into the strength of you. So it's like the strength and the softness are one energy now. That is, that particular combination of qualities and energies is what is needed. Is what is needed, as you understand. Deep on a soul level, Damien, what you understand about yourself is that you're like a pacifist warrior. You're like, yeah, I'll fucking knock you down if you come running at me, but I'm trying to do the right thing here because I care about people and love and oneness. And we say, the record keepers, this is the literal ideal for a human being. For a human being, you know, given what other human beings do at this time, the ideal energy to be able to inhabit or embody is a desire for peace and a willingness to do whatever needs to be done. Does this make some sense?
It does.
Okay, now what about the exhaustion? What would you say to him about, yeah, it's fucking a lot of work to go get into the front lines. And so how is he to navigate that? What wisdom do you have for him, record keepers, if any? What can you tell us about that? That's me just asking, Damien, because I want to know. Well, this is a calling, and a calling will not stop calling. And eventually you'll become so irritated by the call that you'll take action and follow it. it's like with Katie, like with me, they're really guiding me lately to move to this fucking random town called Cortez, Colorado, that I have no egoic personality-based interest in. None, zero. And they're like, yeah, but you don't understand. That's where you're going. So similarly, and I can't get it out of my head, and it comes up in my dreams, and it comes up when I'm walking the dog, and it's everywhere I turn, and everyone I meet on the street is like, hi, I just got back from Cortez, Colorado, and I can't escape it, and it's unavoidable. Similarly, this is a call for you. So you can shut it down for now if you want. It's just going to keep poking at you. And you happen to have the perfect, I mean, you were made for this, spiritually speaking. Mm. What else? Anything else for Damien that you want to throw in there or challenge or push back or ask other things?
Those were my questions.
Okay. There's one thing I need to clarify here for my own sense of being correct about things. There's a kind of energy when you ask the question. So when we say record keepers, is it in Damien's highest good to go do that? There's a particular kind of yes I get on that. Can you help me understand what is that? There's like a hazy energy, like the way that a fog on a window is. What is that? Help me understand what that is so I can tell him. Is it useful? Yes. Okay. What can I tell him about that from you? Okay. Damien. So listen, this is the fog of unconsciousness. This is the fog of sleep that a large part of the population you'll be re-entering function from, the level of sleeping they're doing. You are like a laser beam of truth and light. And standing as that pole, the pole of the laser beam of truth and light, you almost need only stand there and tell the truth. Just by standing there and telling the truth, the fog starts to lift. The hazy, almost like you put a spell on a person and they get a little foggy and then they're just zombie people, right? You being in a room starts to disassemble that fog. Yes, it's dangerous and you're prepared and you will be protected to a certain degree by the light, you know, and by your team of support on the other side. You've also got an army of people who are going to have your back and protect you. If you are so motivated and called, practicing some kind of spiritual practice on the daily would contribute to you having more protection, even more protection on the other side, as it were. And this would be a good time for that. Okay. Is there anything else for him? Not really. I think we're complete unless you have another question, Damien.
I have no other questions except, am I going to get married?
Oh, boy. That's actually almost like a bigger question than the other one. Marriage is... Oh boy. Do you want to get married?
No. It would be nice. It would be nice if it's right. Or even should I be?
Well, is it in his highest good to get married? Well, definitely not right now. Is it in the future? Yes. Okay, what else can you tell us about that, record keepers? Yes, something will make itself a woman. I can actually see her now. She will make herself quite obvious. I see you meeting her in, there's some kind of office or building or meeting place where you're going to meet with people to do your work that you're there to do. And she shows up in that room, that office meeting place. It's like a meeting room, some kind of gathering room. She's a lot smaller than you. Very elegant, beautiful. She kind of floats through space. Mm-hmm. She has kind of a Lisa Bonet quality, but not quite. Like she's more, a little more earthy than that, but there's a kind of ethereal, otherworldly, beautiful, heart-centered quality about her. And it happens in a couple years and it'll be quite obvious. Quite obvious.
I like that.
Yeah. Sometimes I can get names, but right now it's here, a bunch of different names. Anyway, there's that.
All right.
Okay. Well, thank you for your questions and your openness to receiving them. We're going to go ahead and close your records now. So I want to say thank you to the Lords, Masters, and Teachers of the Akashic Records for Damien Dupre Brown. I ask that you return all of Damien's energy back to himself now. Return all of his energy back to himself. Return us both to our complete human wholeness. Return everybody's energy back to their complete human wholeness. The divine portal and the Akashic records for Damien Dupre Brown are now closed. Amen. The divine portal and the Akashic records for Damien Dupre Brown are now closed. Amen. The divine portal and the Akashic records for Damien Dupre Brown are now closed. Amen. 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 Shadow and Lana Hellala, Shadow and Muhammad Abduhu Rasulallah. All right.
All right.
Thank you, Damien.
That was a pleasure. Thank you.
Oh my God. Thank you so much for you giving us such a gift here, such a generous just unloading of truth. And yeah, thank you so much.
A pleasure. I enjoyed it. You know, I enjoyed it.
I know that all of us are very glad. I mean, I can't say enough about how valuable it is for the people who would be listening to this podcast to hear your story. So thank you for sharing it with us.
It's truly a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
All right, Damien. Take care.
All right. I miss you. Talk to you soon.
Talk soon. We're gonna be well.
Have
well.
All right. Virtual beer in the future.
I guess we're done amazing. With that.
That was phenomenal.
God, I could listen to him tell stories forever.
They don't end, and they are each one more astounding than the next. I can't wait for him to finally start writing it in a way that people can read or hear or see. Because
there's just so much I could say. One thing I really was aware of listening to Damien was like, I've had not an easy life. It's not been an easy go, right? And like a lot of pain and trips to the hospital and a lot of trauma and a lot of work to do. And what I have never had to deal with one time that he has dealt with from the moment he existed through now is physical threats to his life. Like, I know that's an obvious thing to say for almost for any Black man, right? Is it's obvious now. Black men feel constantly threatened with their life. And Damien was like raised fighting, physical fist fighting. I mean, if I had to punch a person a time, and then they punched me back one time. You would hear about it for a long, cranky list of minutes because it's so intense physical violence. And then he's in fucking, and then the accident, and then he's in prison, and then constant fighting, and then physical. I was just struck with it over and over again while he was talking, like, I have had to fight a lot of stuff, and I have never had to fight some like threats to my physical life after the original childhood abuses that were quite dangerous to my body. But that was like before I had consciousness, you know, since he's been conscious, and it's radically different. It's radically different. And
right. It's different that it's a sustained assault of existence, as opposed to a series of incidents.
Right. And I mean, every day in a way, like it's like, it reminds me of what Lance Gardner posted on Facebook. I don't know if you saw his post, but he said, look, all of this is great. I'm glad white people are waking up more. I'm glad the protests, I'm glad. And none of this changes the fact that I continue to have to be a Black man in America forever. I'm still going to be a Black guy tomorrow, meaning I'm never going to know when I walk down the street and someone crosses the street, is it because it was windy over there or because I'm a Black guy? When I don't get served at a restaurant, when I don't get a job, when I don't get a, he's like, these assaults, these questions of my, these not having the benefit of the doubt moments, these judgments, these active aggressions, these microaggressions, they're going to still exist because I'm always going to be a Black man. And I just, listening to Damien, I was just like, I can feel the cumulative minutes, just minute after minute after minute of that physical assault on your physical person. What an incredible man he is to be as kind and generous and loving, given all the givens. When am I being cranky ever? When am I being cranky? What am I mad about? Who made me upset at Target? Do you understand what I'm asking? It's like,
yeah.
What? You get it.
Yeah. Fuck. I just keep saying fuck. It's like the biggest word right now.
Well, I think this is the mind fuck we're all supposed to be having. And we're getting mind fucked and we need to get mind fucked. It's like that image of, I pictured like the universe fucking me in the ear and it's like blowing my brain out of the other ear so that there's just nothing left so I can start anew.
Yeah. Word. So true.
And on that note, Thank you. Good night.
Good night, everybody.
All right. I'm out. I love you guys.
I love you to pieces. Bye.
Talk to you soon.
Were you asking for all of the answers? Say what? All of the answers? Yeah, all the answers.
Hey, guys. Thanks for listening. We'd love to hear from you. Please email us with your questions so that we have questions to answer in the Akashic Records. Our email address is allanswerspod@gmail.com. That's allanswerspod@gmail.com. And if you'd like to find us on Facebook or Twitter, it's @allanswerspod. Thank you.